Welcome to another TeachingAmericanHistory.org podcast. TAH.org is the leading online resource for documents, resources, and programs related to American history, government, and civics for teachers, students, and citizens.
Excellent. Great. All right. Well, welcome everybody to another TeachingAmericanHistory.org Saturday webinar sponsored by the Ashbrook Center at Ashland University. TAH.org is the leading online resource for the documents-based study of American history, government, and civics for teachers, students, and citizens. I'm Chris Burkett, Associate Professor of Political Science here at Ashland University. And as you know, the theme of this year's webinar series is Great American Debates. And just in case you happen to be joining us for the first time, the idea is to pull together some very thoughtful scholars and thinkers on these debates, and we happen to have two very good ones today, and help us think about how do we approach these big moments, these great debates in American history. And as always, I invite you to join into that conversation by submitting questions in the chat feature. I ask that you, when you submit your questions, you submit them to all participants and not me privately. That way, if you do it that way, then our panelists today can maybe glance at them, or if they happen to see a question that's being submitted and they want to jump on it right away, they don't have to wait for me to raise it. So please feel free to submit some questions, and we'll try to get to as many of those as possible. As always, in the next link, you'll receive an email. Next week, you'll receive an email with a link to request a certificate of participation, as well as a link to the archived video and audio from today's program. I got a chat message from Frederick that he did not receive that email, so I am typing my email address in the chat box right now. Hopefully everybody can see it. If you didn't get that link or that email last week, just shoot me a quick email, and I'll pass that on to the proper authorities. Make sure that you get that email, okay? So just shoot me an email. So today we're talking about the debate on over the election of 1932, FDR versus Hoover. And I'm very happy to introduce our scholars joining us this morning. Very happy to have Joe Postel, who has written extensively on Congress and administrative things, and Hoover and FDR as well. Joe teaches at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. Of course, is a very long-time friend of Ashbrook, and does a lot of great things for us. I also happen to be joined by my friend and colleague John Moser, who teaches history here at Ashland University, and he has also written on Hoover and FDR. So we have two very thoughtful folks here this morning who hopefully will have plenty of great things to say about this debate. So thanks to both of you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
I'm going to start with a broad question, and let's be broad so that you can do whatever you want with it and take it in any direction you want, including ignoring it if you'd like. I noticed in the speeches in the 1932 election, the political rhetoric coming from Hoover and FDR both, the language really ratchets up this election to the level of talking about sort of fundamental political ideas. Both Hoover and Roosevelt say repeatedly, this election is about something more than just a change of policy. This is an election that will determine the direction of the country and maybe fundamentally transform the country in some important ways. So I'm wondering if both of you might start by thinking about what brought us to the point at which this becomes such a crossroads type election, if you will, in the minds of these candidates. What got us to this point? And then for both Hoover and FDR, what's at stake in the outcome? What is it they think will either positively or negatively transform this country, depending on the outcome of the election? So would either of you like to start? Joe, would you like to start?
Sure, yeah. I'm very interested in what John has to say in response to that question, too. But so I'll make my opening sort of thoughts on that brief, and be interested in reacting to what he thinks about this. But, you know, there's a part of me that thinks that sometimes we read this election as a critical crossroads election that determines the future of the country only in the benefit of, with the benefit of hindsight. And one of the things I find so interesting about this election, when you go back and read the original sources, which is something I learned to do thanks in part to Ashland, and which is so critical, especially with this election, is that the original sources don't make the two candidates sound exactly like we think that they should sound if we just read what subsequent scholars have said about them. FDR sounds a little bit like a conservative or a laissez-faire critic of Hoover, and Hoover sounds a little bit like a progressive when you read some of these, just the 1932 era speeches. And seems like the election itself had a lot of rhetoric that doesn't actually match what happens afterwards. And so I think that's a really fascinating thing for us to explore as we kind of talk about what's at stake, what they, you know, what each candidate had to say or what each candidate thought about the other. So it's really interesting to go back and read these speeches and see that, you know, the versions of FDR and Hoover in 1932 aren't really what we got afterwards.
That's certainly right when you look at specifics. FDR did not want to really talk about specific policies. What the things he tended to harp on were Hoover spending too much, tariffs, that had been a Democratic talking point since at least since the days of Jackson, and ending prohibition. Right. So if you looked like a laundry list of here's what FDR is going to do, that's about all you're going to come up with. But if you look at the Commonwealth Club address, for example, there are some real clues that there's more radical stuff going on in the background. In fact, Hoover, and I don't think we had this speech. Hoover gives a speech very late in the campaign at Madison Square Garden, where he talks about the consequences of the proposed New Deal. And Hoover even says in this speech, I can't go too much on the basis of what FDR, what my opponent says, because he's been so very nonspecific. But I can look at what the Democrats have proposed the last 2 years since they've had a majority in the House. And we can, you know, we can use that. We can extrapolate from certain things that FDR says. But directly in response to Chris's question, why does this become why is this such an ideological election? I think it's simply because of the nature of the crisis, an economic crisis unlike any that the country had faced before. That certainly the country had had economic shocks in the past, but nothing that lasted this long and was this severe. And in that environment, radical suggestions come forward. And you need to remember that FDR and many of those who were in FDR's camp had been associated with the Wilson administration during World War I. And they had come away with the strong belief that the programs that had been put into place to win the war had been effective, and that they provided a blueprint for what could be done in the face of a new crisis, right? They accepted that with the war over, a lot of these agencies and bureaus are going to be dismantled. But they always held in the back of their mind the belief that this is how we can rally the nation to deal with some kind of crisis. Maybe it's not a war, maybe it's an economic crisis.
And that, the great irony there is that Hoover, of course, played a central role in that World War I centralized governmental effort to deal with the crisis of that period.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Hoover is one of his biographers, Joan Hoff Wilson. Her biography was titled "Forgotten Progressive."
Yeah.
Very much. I mean, it's easy to forget. He was a bull moose Republican in 1912.
Yeah. So why, can I just ask, why then is this the effect of the rhetoric coming from the Roosevelt campaign? Did they try to portray him as this sort of backwards conservative type, whose affiliation with these policies, with certain policies, has led us into this crisis? Hmm. And why was, if that's true, why was Hoover so ineffective in countering that or did he not want to be remembered as a bull moose progressive or Republican in this election?
Well, that's a good question. So the first thing I think that is relevant to that is the nature of political parties during this period and how heterogeneous they are. So today, and just for the last several decades, we're so accustomed to thinking of parties as these cohesive, ideologically united entities that it's hard for us to understand the nature of parties during the 1932 election and in years around that. So, you know, Democrats obviously were very much divided between conservatives and progressives, or if anything, they were more conservative party than the Republican Party was. And so FDR is kind of trying to be really careful here because he's still reliant heavily on his party for support, and he doesn't want to sound too far out of the mainstream of the Democratic Party, which is, again, sort of rooted in the South, rooted in this Jeffersonian, Jacksonian tradition of limited government and states' rights. And so that's on the one side. And then Hoover, of course, being so part of the progressive Republican faction. But the 1920s have been ruled by Harding and Coolidge before Hoover, and those two represent a much more conservative or a much more limited government sort of approach to republicanism. And so in a way, I think both of them, the rhetoric has to be contained by the party structure that surrounds them. And especially FDR, who I think really does talk a lot about Hoover being way too centralizing, way too interested in bureaucratizing the economy. If you read some of FDR's rhetoric in 1932, he's condemning Hoover for doing the very things that he's going to do once he becomes president. And so I think part of the answer to that is that the parties themselves have their distinct identities and the candidates are kind of subservient to those party ideologies. That might be, I think that's not the full answer, but I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's interesting to note that the first speech we have here, Hoover's Principles and Ideals of the United States Government, was a campaign speech in the election of 1928 against Al Smith. But if you know anything about Al Smith, he was arguably the conservative in that race.
Yeah.
And Hoover always felt like he had to worry about challenges to his right in his own party. And so it's no surprise, therefore, that he's making, even without mentioning Smith, he's making the Democrats out in 1928 to be wild-eyed radicals when they really weren't. Their standard bearer was arguably more conservative than Hoover was. But he's concerned about, Coolidge himself never liked Hoover. Coolidge thought Hoover was kind of a wild-eyed radical himself. So he's really in 1928 is trying to assuage the conservative wing of his own party, and he takes that up again. The tenor of his campaign in 32 is very much like 1928.
Yeah, I find this fascinating, by the way, that the Hoover and the Roosevelt that we see in the months leading up to the election. Those are not necessarily the real Hoover and the real FDR in terms of what their real views with regard to the role of government are should be. So I find that really fascinating. In the and John, you mentioned Hoover's speech on the consequences of the New Deal, and I wish that had been part of that collection because I think that's a really important speech. He does have criticisms in that speech of the New Deal. Again, as you were saying earlier, Roosevelt's being so big because Roosevelt wants to talk about these sort of bigger ideas about the role of government and the history, you know, sort of the tradition of government and how we've arrived at a certain point to finally perhaps, build on our, on the sort of direction we've been tending toward a greater or better use of government for these sorts of things. But Hoover does have some specific critiques in that speech, right, of the New Deal. It seems to me one of them is the idea that the New Deal is calling for government to get into the business of business, right? And I think primarily in the energy business, right, having to do with the building of dams and Muscle Shoals, I think, was part of that. But Hoover's larger critique is has to do with the notion that he sort of gleaned from Roosevelt's New Deal ideas, that we've somehow arrived at this sort of end of history, that we no longer need to build up our infrastructure, that we've arrived at the point that the job of government is simply to make better, more efficient use of the resources we've already got at hand. And it always struck me that Hoover's main concern is that that's a kind of teaching of, I don't want to overdo this here, but it's almost like a teaching of death or stagnation, right? So my sense of what Hoover's critique is of the New Deal is that it will affect the nation, transform the nation in the sense that it will undermine the idea that the growth and progress and development and these things are still really important, which again, ironically, makes Hoover sound more like the progressive in a certain sense, as opposed to Roosevelt. Go ahead, sorry, please. I'm just thinking out loud.
He does seize on the Commonwealth Club address and that part about the Day of Enlightened Administration.
Yeah.
The growth is behind us, but that is almost the only. Even though the speech is about the proposed New Deal, that's the only thing he really seizes on that comes from Roosevelt. Everything else, as I think I mentioned before, he gets from other things that Democrats have proposed, right? So when he mentions government getting into the power business, FDR, to the best of my knowledge, at no point in the 1932 campaign said, if elected, I'm going to have Muscle Shoals, you know, operate and sell electricity to get into the electricity business. I don't think he ever endorsed that. But because the Democrats had pushed for that for so often in the 1920s, Hoover could be reasonably sure that that is going to be a feature of the new. But FDR is just so slippery in 1932, he won't really go for understandable reasons, right? FDR kind of understands he has this locked up. As long as he doesn't screw up, he's going to win this election. So there's nothing to be gained by getting specific. All you're going to do is alienate potential supporters. And there were plenty of conservatives, as Joe alludes to, there were plenty of conservative Democrats in 1932 who looked at FDR as a safe option. By 1936, they were in total opposition. But in 1932, yeah, he still looks safe.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. So that might, Joe, that might help explain in part a comment you made earlier about how in some ways FDR used very conservative anyway sounding language, right? So that's the election FDR for perhaps reasons John was mentioning, and no need to get too specific and sound too radical.
Yeah, I think so. There's a short-term calculation FDR is making, which John has just suggested. You know, if you're the out party in a terrible crisis, what you really have to do is to just be vague enough and criticize the people that are in power, and you're going to win the election. Then there's more of a long-term structural thing going on, too, at the same time, again, which goes back to the question of political parties and how they affect candidates back then. I mean, today we think of political parties, we think that they're a lot more powerful than they really are, but today candidates essentially run as independents. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody reads party platforms, nobody thinks that candidates have to pledged to support the platform or bound in any way to them, in part because we now nominate candidates through primaries where the people choose the candidates directly instead of the parties nominating them in conventions like they did still largely by 1932. And so FDR is having to sort of, you know, be very careful in not straying too far from that orthodoxy. He pledges himself to support the 1932 Democratic platform, which of course he has to do because the party has nominated him.
Right.
And that platform is very much in the vein, in line with the old democratic ideology, philosophy of limited government. Once he starts to stray, as John just mentioned, once he starts to stray in office from that orthodoxy, he takes a lot of heat from his own party. Very similar to some, you know, subsequent developments when presidents get out of the orthodoxy of their party and they start to take fire from their own party members. At there's the formation of this group called the American Liberty League, which is composed of, and this is amazing, really, if you think about it from the present day point of view, the American Liberty League is formed by John Davis, who's the 24 Democratic Party candidate, and Al Smith, who's the 28 Democratic Party candidate, and the former head of the DNC. So basically, it would be as if Mitt Romney and John McCain formed a group while President Trump was in office to oppose Trump. That's kind of like what's going on by Democrats during the New Deal. And so I think that's why the pre-election FDR and the post-election FDR, in some ways that explains why they're very different.
Yeah, I was thinking that the Never Trump, the Never Trump movement is the closest thing we have to the American Liberty League.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. So, but there, by the way, you know, there were there not signs to the Democrat? Again, the first question is, to what extent is the Democratic Party sort of monolithic at the time, or is there a progressive element to the Democratic Party, or are they still largely the party of that tradition stretching back to, in their minds, to Jeffersonian republicanism with limited government and these things? But I'm wondering if there weren't people within the Democratic Party, even during the election, that didn't see certain things, the kinds of things Roosevelt was doing and saying, that might have indicated that he was the sort of guy who was going to potentially buck party tradition or even the party platform. I'm thinking specifically, for example, the fact that Roosevelt seemed to, I mean, he broke tradition by flying to the Democratic nominating convention to be there in person to accept the nomination. Maybe that didn't seem like such a big deal back then, but I seem to recall reading things that people thought this was perhaps an indication of the way Roosevelt was going to do things. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Hopefully at some point we'll get into the substance of the Commonwealth Club address. It seems like there are, again, somewhat conservative language there, but some of the ways he describes things, I would wonder whether or not anybody was, even among the Democratic Party, were saying, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like us. I'm just,
yeah.
I guess to bring my question to a clear moment, sorry, I'm thinking out loud, is how much support did Roosevelt actually get from the Democratic Party at the election?
I don't know the answer as well as I'm sure John does, but as you were thinking about this, I think there are really important points that, you know, as you were thinking about this in the question you raised, because there's one interesting little rule. I mean, you're right, the Democratic Party is composed of both progressive and conservative elements, to use language that they wouldn't have used, but that we use today. Woodrow Wilson, of course, is kind of a sign of what's to come for the Democratic Party. And there are Northern Democrats, and so there's still some, you know, mixture there. But the problem in terms of, for them to sort of rule the party, is that the South is so heavily Democratic as sort of a legacy of the Civil War that they're sort of outweighed. And there's this really interesting rule that in the Democratic Party nomination that you had to get 2/3 of the delegates to get the presidential nomination. Mm. That was a holdover from late or the middle of the 19th century, when sort of regional alliance, you know, regional groups basically said, we want a veto power. It's almost like Calhoun's concurrent majority applied to presidential nominations. Yeah. So they had supermajority requirements to get the nomination so that nobody could just get a bare majority, ignore the southern part of the Democratic Party, and then take over the party that way. Roosevelt, interestingly, in 1940, works with the party to eliminate that rule. So Roosevelt, this doesn't speak necessarily to how much support he gets from the party in 32, but of course in 1938, he embarks on what they call the purge campaign, where he starts to try to purge anti-New Deal Democrats from the party. And then in 40, he tries to change the nomination rules so that he doesn't need the South as heavily to get the nomination. So he's clearly aware that if he's too reliant on his party, it constrains him in ways that he doesn't want to be constrained.
That's very interesting. Yeah, very,
yeah. The party was all in for him in 19, FDR in 1932. And to find someone else. Will Rogers had famously said, I belong to no organized political party, I'm a Democrat. this had been a problem with the Democrats for a long time, being able to unite the disparate wings of it. And Wilson had really pointed the way to how you do that. And that is to be progressive enough that you're going to win over the liberals, but conservative enough that you're going to keep the South. And that was what FDR managed to do again. Now, FDR's big challenger for the nomination in 1932 was John Nance Garner of Texas. a man who had the support of the Hearst interests. He was a very strong candidate, but also very, very conservative. And while he was the favorite of the South, he wasn't going to do enough or attract enough support from liberal Northeastern Democrats to get the nomination, which is why he kind of stalled out, and then at a certain point he cuts a deal where he gets the vice presidency in exchange for committing his delegates to FDR. Garner had famously said that the vice presidency isn't worth a warm pitcher of spit, is what the term that got into the newspapers. He didn't say spit. He had a saucier name for it than that. He was famously profane as a politician.
Yeah. John, that, your point though about FDR sort of imitating the approach of Wilson and being just liberal enough but just conservative enough to satisfy both sides of the party—that's a great point. And I wonder if that's one of the things that reveals in what sense. When Roosevelt said in his acceptance speech at the Democratic nominating convention, he referred to Woodrow Wilson as his great progressive captain. It seems like this is one of the, I think, many things personally in which he has learned things or imitating or building on things that he's picked up from Wilson, that Wilson actually did well. So we have a question from Shaylin, who wants to know specifically about how Roosevelt treated Hoover between the election and the inauguration. So that may be getting a little bit ahead, but can we talk a little bit about their relationship in general? Did they know each other? They must have politically, right? Say something about this and how they interacted with each other, or maybe specifically from Shaylin's question, why did Roosevelt reject Hoover's offer to help?
I think it's fair to say these two men loathed one another. And it became very personal between them. I think part of that is because they were both surprisingly small men of course, they had big personality, big egos, and all that, but they were both really kind of petty and spiteful as individuals. Hoover, for example, Hoover wasn't a politician, for one thing, right? It's amazing. The only elective office Hoover ever held was President of the United States. It's an amazing thing to consider. He disdained politicians, right? Hoover was an engineer. He was all about solving problems, which ironically is why FDR kind of admired him in 1920 and thought, well, I wonder if we could get Hoover as our candidate for president. Because nobody knew what his politics were at that point. They just knew he worked for the Wilson administration, so thought, hey, he must be a Democrat.
Huh.
But then FDR is a consummate politician. Hoover's view of FDR was, this guy's a total lightweight who doesn't know what he's doing. He's just charming, handsome, sounds good on the radio, but that's what makes him dangerous. If he has controls of the levers of power, he's gonna make a hash of it because he's an amateur. He's merely a politician.
John, do you think Hoover was right about that?
And Roosevelt saw, yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt your.
To a certain extent, yes. I think FDR was smarter than Hoover gave him credit for.
No, not at all.
And FDR looked upon Hoover as better. Hoover was a jerk. Henry Stimson. and it was mutual. So both Hoover and FDR were good haters, and took politics very personally. There was one incident when FDR was governor of New York, Hoover was president, and FDR was supposed to meet with Hoover along with some other governors, I believe. I'm a little fuzzy on these details, but he was kept waiting for a long time without a place to sit, and Hoover was unaware, as most people were, of the extent of FDR's disability. And that was obviously extremely uncomfortable for FDR to have to not be in a sitting position for a long period, and FDR seems to have taken that as a personal slight. I don't think it was intended as one.
That's interesting. But John, when you were talking about Hoover's view of FDR as kind of a consummate politician, but not that knowledgeable about, you know, the actual formulation of policies in order to deal with things. I wonder if there isn't some evidence for that in the fact that FDR is well known for surrounding himself with, of course, what comes to be known as the brain trust, which interestingly enough was originally called the Privy Council, but was changed for sort of optics purposes. But FDR did surround himself with a lot of advisors, right? Economic advisors, planning advisors. And I wonder if either of you, Joe, perhaps would like to say something about the extent to which, I mean, how much of the New Deal as it came out of, or as it was implemented after the election was Roosevelt, and how much of it was some of these new ideas that are being put forth by his policy advisors?
Yeah. So I'll take a shot at that and then be happy to be corrected by John, who I think will have the more definitive and correct answer. But my sense is that FDR, I think there are multiple ways to read FDR, and scholars have kind of taken it in different directions. But the one interpretation that makes the most sense to me, or that I tend to subscribe to, is that he's sort of not that particularly ideological. Again, I take the rhetoric of 32, the campaign, to be pretty important to indicate that he's not committed deeply to sort of progressivism the way somebody like Wilson was, who intellectually just, you know, imbibed it so deeply. And that he wants to just be an active politician. There are some statements, you know, early on where FDR says something like, what's really important is that we're doing something. It's not really critical that we have the right plan. It's just important for people to see that we're addressing problems by being proactive about it. And I think in some ways, a lot of the sort of heavy progressivism of the New Deal, I do think in some ways comes from more of the advisors and less from FDR, because he's more political and less sort of ideologically committed the way Wilson was. I'm not entirely certain about that, but that's mostly the reading I've kind of come to from some of the things I've looked at.
Go ahead, John, please.
Sorry, I think that's right. FDR, but we have to be careful about going too far in the other direction and arguing, as some have, that FDR was basically an empty suit, a mouthpiece for others. For example, FDR relied far more heavily on speechwriters than his predecessors did.
Hmm.
But that's led some historians to say, you know what, in a given speech, all you really need to do is pay attention to who the speechwriter was, and FDR is parroting his ideas. But that's not true. If you look at the texts of these speeches, they are heavily marked up by FDR himself. He is injecting his own ideas. But certainly what Joe's saying about actual New Deal policies, aside from a general sense that we have to keep trying things, he is not, with the exception of one policy, the Civilian Conservation Corps, that was FDR's baby.
Mm.
Everything else was more a product of others. Of course, he had an influence on shaping it, but the Agricultural Adjustment Act, the National Industrial Recovery Act, all of these early New Deal things were really products of the brain trust. And FDR had nothing in comparison. Hoover had nothing similar. Because Hoover was always convinced of his own rightness.
Yeah. He was his own. He was his own brain trust, right?
Exactly. No, he really thought that.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. So, I think of this is very enlightening and revealing, and to me, it puts even more emphasis on the importance of, like, the Rex Tugwells and others that are advising FDR. That seems to me, perhaps, maybe, is something for me to think about in the future, where the ideology mixed with this real sense of the need for experimentalism really comes from those sorts of advisees. or advisors, I should say, right?
But since we're on this question of FDR and Hoover's relationship, sorry, Chris. I actually have a question for John. Do you think that this sort of tense relationship, or even just an icy relationship between the two, had some effect on Hoover's very significant change of rhetoric after the election? Hoover's sort of conversion to a Coolidge kind of conservative after the election has always fascinated me. And I never really understood how deep the distrust or the dislike was between the two men. So was it that that caused Hoover to go so far in the opposite direction, or are there other causes there?
That's part of it. He also reacted very negatively against the narrative that said Hoover was a failure, and then FDR stepped in and everything started getting better and getting better again. He was very bitter about that. He said, "Look, I made a good faith effort, but things were stacked against me." Even then, there were periods when things looked like they were getting better, but then stuff outside of my control happened that caused things to go wrong. He felt that he was being made the villain of the whole Depression and New Deal drama.
Yeah.
So he doesn't, it's right away that he emerged as a critic of FDR, but in fact, journalists are coming, he gave them sound bites. But interestingly, Hoover never had a nice thing to say about the American Liberty League. He said that was the Wall Street idea of liberty. A very interesting thing for Hoover to say, and criticized them on that ground. So he didn't get on board with that opposition.
That was interesting. Yeah, that's a great question, Joe. And there's a Candy submitted a question that's sort of tied to this. So it's a two-part question. Why did Hoover jump in quickly to help rebuilding Europe on the humanitarian side, but not jump in so quickly to deal with the Depression and the causes of the Depression in the United States? First of all, is that true or not? Is that the right? Is that an accurate portrayal of Hoover's actions with regard to the Depression? And then the second part of Candy's question is why did he not handle this better during the election in terms of explaining what he would have done with regard to fixing the problems we were facing in 32?
I would suspect my answer to the first part is pretty short, but I would defer to John. My sense is that, you know, what John just said, right, is that he's sort of being blamed for the problem and also shut out by his opponents who really disliked him personally. And so my sense is that he probably would have felt a little uncomfortable or even a little embarrassed trying to sort of help with efforts back at home. And Europe's kind of a nice place to go because you can still help without kind of being involved in all of that messiness.
Yeah. Did Hoover have, by the way, did Hoover make, I mean, did he have, so I have to be careful how I do this, because one of the things I noticed about FDR that seemed to really help him was, even with his vague rhetoric, he has this vision thing, right? As we know, this presidential campaigns have to have a vision of the future and how we're not only going to address specific things, but how we're going to keep the country moving in whatever this round direction might be. Did Hoover have either of those two things in his campaign rhetoric? Do either of you know? I mean, did he make specific, was he saying, this is how we're going to fix this, and what do we need to do here?
And this gets back to Candy's question. I think Hoover would have rejected the idea that his approach to the Depression was different than his approach to the food situation in Europe at the end of the war. First of all, he would have said this is a different kind of crisis because the war itself has destroyed so much of any efforts for private relief within Europe itself. So what's Hoover's response as food administrator? It's to really coordinate private efforts in the United States to feed Europe. And Hoover always believed this is certainly within the scope of the federal government to coordinate and assist private efforts without replacing them. So when the Depression comes, right? They're very quickly, some in Congress say, well, federal money should be going to private relief. And he says, no, that's not what this is about. I've spoken to the Red Cross and all kinds of private organizations, and they assure me that they can continue to provide food aid, you know, and local movements and churches. So all of these can take care of that stuff. That's not to say there are other things that the federal government should also be doing, in which he did. But he said that if the federal government gets involved in direct relief, it's going to supplant private efforts. In the case of Europe, in Europe in 1919, the private efforts in Europe were not existent, but he was enlisting private help at home.
I see. Oh, that's great. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think, can I just add a little bit to that? Yes. You know, there's this famous speech, or I don't know if it's famous because people later on have seized upon it, which I don't think has a name, but which Gordon Lloyd, who's done a lot of really good work on Hoover, has called the constructive side of government speech. It's in St. Louis, I think in 1928, where Hoover says, let me outline what I think is the constructive side of government. And it's a lot of the activities that he had been undertaking as both in the Coolidge administration and then as president, which is, again, sort of more helping and assisting private efforts to coordinate activity, to exchange information. Like, standardization was a really big effort for him, that he thought that these were ways in which you could sort of enhance prosperity without having the federal government exercise this heavy hand over it. And I think that's kind of his vision thing. And the other speech, which I actually was reading for the first time to get ready for this morning's conversation, is the first speech in the document reader here, The Principles and Ideals of the United States Government. And with a title like that, you expect the vision thing to come through really heavily. And it does. I mean, essentially, if you read the speech, it's a really good and interesting speech. It does outline, I think, a pretty serious political philosophy. But I think there are two problems with it. The first is it's essentially negative. He's talking about bureaucracy requires centralization of accountability and responsibility. Self-government requires decentralization and checks and balances. And if you try to have government take over business, it essentially needs to abandon its decentralization and checks and balances and concentrate power, which I think he's right about. But it's mostly a criticism rather than a statement of ideals and principles. Yeah. And the second problem of the speech, and I think this is, I might just quickly read from the speech because I think it's, this is, you know, the page I have is 90. I think this is a really important challenge that people like Hoover face when they're talking about regulation. So he starts talking about how government needs to back off. It can't centralize power. It can't bureaucratize industry. Then he says, but I don't wish to be misunderstood in this statement. I'm defining a general policy. It does not mean that government is to part with one iota of its national resources without complete protection of the public interest. And then a famous passage in the next paragraph, he says, nor do I wish to be misinterpreted as believing that the United States is free for all and devil take the hindmost. He says, this is no system of laissez-faire. So he's just criticized over-regulation and over-centralization and bureaucratization. And then he comes back around and says, but hold on, let me make sure that I clarify to you that I'm not a laissez-faire person either. So the question then becomes, well, okay, if you criticize too much regulation, but you're not a laissez-faire advocate either, what's your principle in between those two extremes? And how do you outline that? And how do you explain it in a way that's going to make it seem like to people that you are not just masking laissez-faire motivations under rhetoric that says you're not a laissez-faire advocate?
I don't see him. I don't see him as being anti-regulation. In fact, he goes on to say, years ago, top of 91, years ago, the Republican administration established the principle that such evils could be corrected by regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So he's actually all for regulation. One of his big criticism, you know, when FDR touted the National Industrial Recovery Act and those the NRA codes for getting rid of child labor, Hoover's response was, look, you didn't need all these codes to get rid of child labor. You just could have, you know, there could have been a regulation passed. You could pass a law banning child labor. his what he always said, though, was it's one thing for government to say private businesses are not allowed to do this, and another thing for the federal government actually to step in competition with private business. This was the bright line that he never wanted to cross.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Joe, please.
So I totally agree that Hoover is not a laissez-faire advocate. The difficulty that I'm trying to suggest here is that it's hard for him not to sound like one. And the principle, as John just set forth, just explained it very concisely. I think if Hoover could have explained it that clearly, he would have been in much better shape in 1932.
Hello? Have I lost everyone?
I think we just jumped back in.
Oh, okay. Sorry, dog's running around. Did we lose Chris?
I think we may have lost our host.
Oh, all right.
I dropped for...
Yeah. Let's see. Okay, here's Stephanie Campbell asks, would it be fair to say that he was, I guess it was Hoover, he was wrongly criticized for not wanting the central government to become too strong? What do you think, Joe?
I think that was an unfair criticism of Hoover. That, you know, again, we sort of apply these categories that we have today back to the 1932 election and say, well, Hoover was just a stand-patter, do-nothing kind of person because he criticized over-regulation and over-centralization. And I think one of the things that we miss about the period when we look at it that way is that Hoover himself was in favor of government activity. He just wanted to put some limit on that that I don't think FDR was willing to observe, especially once he got into power. So, you know, one part of this that I think is interesting to make sure we address is the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, because that's essentially, you know, when FDR gives this speech where he outlines, you know, three basic ideas, lending to banks and to farmers. He talks about allowing for more spending power for farmers and then tariff policy. He sounds like he's actually kind of advocating what the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was already doing. His only criticism, he says, of Hoover is that, well, all the money went to the rich people, and he's going to make sure that it goes from the bottom up and not the top down.
I'm back, by the way, guys. Sorry about that. I got booted for some reason. So
no problem.
Keep going, please. It's good.
Yeah, Reconstruction the Finance Corporation, it's easy to overstate the difference between Hoover and FDR. Rexford Tugwell said at one point in the 1930s that Hoover's administration really laid the groundwork for the New Deal. Reconstruction Finance Corporation was a major departure in U.S. policy, that there was this going to be this huge pot of money available to basically bail out banks and insurance companies and railroads and other major financial concerns. But as Joe points out, it was easy to demagogue this issue by saying, "Oh, look, all that Hoover cares about is his rich buddies." And then there was a big push to publicize in the newspapers all of the banks and other firms that got RFC loans.
Hmm.
Now, the problem with doing this, and in the full version of Hoover's letter to Simon Fess, which there's an abbreviated version in this interview, in the full version of it, he points out how disastrous this was. Let's say you have your money in a bank, and then you read in the newspaper that your bank is one of the institutions that got an RFC loan. Well, what does that tell you? That may not be terribly sound. So this really caused a ripple effect through the economy. The very worst part of the Depression was in that couple of months between the from January to March 1933, and this was part of the reason for it.
Hmm. Do you see parallels between the Great Depression and then the 2008 situation in which, again, you have bailouts, but everybody thinks the money's going to Wall Street, so everybody gets angry. Then you get a bunch of rhetoric about how we need to do exactly the same thing. We just need to do it differently so that Wall Street doesn't benefit from it.
Yeah, definitely. TARP is the RFP of 2009.
Yeah, but by the way, doesn't the idea of a stimulus, isn't that a very important aspect of some of the things Roosevelt's economic advisors are calling for? Is that the first time the idea of a stimulus type thing was implemented in the New Deal? Do you know? The idea that you inject money into the economy and maybe even print money if you need to get it flowing, and it'll.
The classic statement of this was, well, because this is John Maynard Keynes,
right.
And you could define it if you define it as we're going to put money out there just to get people back to work. Hoover certainly expanded public works projects specifically for the purpose of generating employment. Now he always hedged and said, these have to be projects that have real value. They're not just going to be make-work projects. This is stuff that we could use anyway. He preferred stuff like toll roads because they're going to make them back. But he was certainly willing to spend federal money to get to get people back to work.
Yeah.
But the thing about stimulus, Keynes wrote to FDR on a few occasions and consistently, what he said to FDR is, you're not spending enough money for a real stimulus. And in fact, all of your reform efforts are scaring businesses out of investing. So Keynes really came off as kind of a conservative in that regard. He talked about the animal spirits of businessmen getting spooked because you couldn't predict what the New Deal was going to do next. So Keynes' comments to FDR was, knock it off with all these new laws and new agencies. Just pump money into the economy and everything will be okay.
Wow. That's very interesting.
And yeah. FDR doesn't really do anything like that. A little bit in response to the 1937 recession. Then he starts spending money in a way that he hadn't in the past.
Yeah. The WPA and the projects building schools, that came earlier or later?
It was earlier, but it's easy to exaggerate the amount of spending that was involved. It wasn't, and in fact, FDR was fairly obsessed with trying to balance the budget. It wasn't just campaign rhetoric. He cut spending in all kinds of areas in order to spend more on things like the WPA.
That's interesting. And that raises a question, of course, because as we know, Congress technically controls the money, right? So it seems to me in order for him to increase spending, he's got to get the cooperation or at least compliance of Congress on these things. Well, what was Roosevelt's relationship with Congress like? And how, maybe even it, knowing a little bit about this, how did he transform the relationship of the presidents with Congress? Joe, you've written about Congress here and there.
Yeah. I think the sort of shock of the 1932 election itself, as well as just the crisis, naturally moves a lot of the power in that relationship over to the presidency. And so the one episode that immediately jumps to mind is how quickly the emergency banking bill is passed. I think it's passed in like the time span of like 8 hours, and Congress basically just rubber stamps it. The strange thing about that is if you sort of look at what's going on in Congress at the time, in part it's because, again, FDR has a lot of power. He's just won a decisive election. There are coattails. And I think he's now clearly got a national audience and a national voice. And so members of Congress are a little bit afraid to take him on. But there are a lot of people who do take him on, and pretty severely. My favorite illustration of this is Carter Glass, who was a Democratic senator from Virginia, who I won't get the quote exactly correct, says something like the New Deal is the most audacious attempt to transplant Hitlerism into this country than that we've ever seen, or something like that. Now, that's later on in the 30s, but so maybe as things as you get further removed from 32, Congress starts to reassert itself a little bit, but at the beginning, it's almost entirely subservient, it seems to me.
Yeah, especially after the 34 midterm elections, the Republican Party, I mean, there were so few Republicans after the 1934 elections that they could be safely ignored. And in fact, the result of the 34 elections really led FDR to go farther with his reforms than he had been willing to up to that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. So, let's see, we've got about 15 minutes or so left. So, we started off our conversation by pointing out how unlike FDR, the FDR after the election, how unlike he didn't sound like that FDR in his campaign speeches. In what ways is FDR different after the election? Maybe that's not the right way to ask it. What comes out of it? Let me ask it this way. Do you think FDR went into the presidency with some broad, almost, I don't want to say vague, that might be not the right way to say it, but vague notion of a New Deal? And how did what comes to be known as the New Deal actually sort of manifest itself? How was it created? I'd especially like your thoughts on the Agricultural Adjustment Act and the National Industrial Recovery Act, which seem to be two of the more important aspects of the New Deal. How were those things, how were they developed, and how important were they to this idea of a New Deal that Roosevelt articulated? And maybe what was the short or long term impact of those two acts in particular?
So I think I might try to answer first, just because I want to hear what John. I'll pose a few questions as I answer to John and see what he has to say about this. But if you read some of these speeches from FDR in 32, I'm thinking in particular, obviously, of the Commonwealth Club address, but the Forgotten Man speech as well in April. So the Forgotten Man speech is April. The Commonwealth Club is in September of 32. He's talking about a New Deal, and he's sort of using some of this language, right? But what I see happening here is a pretty strong bridge between the old populist Democratic Party and the new populist Democratic Party. The old populist Democratic Party is, you know, the more power is given to the government, the more it can give power to commercial interests that are aligned with the government. And that's essentially the Jeffersonian, Madisonian, Jacksonian critique of the Federalists and the Whigs prior to the Civil War. And so the Democratic Party at its roots, at its creation, is always a populist party. It's always sort of the Democratic Party and not the not the Whig Party or something like that. But the difference here is that now the economy is changed in a fundamental way. And so industrialization and sort of the growth of large-scale business means that we have to use government now to intervene on behalf of the populist interest rather than keeping government out of the economy to protect populist interests. And there's a part of I think it's the Forgotten Man speech, where FDR, this is actually his acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention. This is on the top of page 97 of the reader, where he starts talking about basically the 1920s was this great decade of growth and prosperity, the Roaring Twenties. But here's the thing: it all went to all the profits went to the corporations. Wages did not go up. The consumer was forgotten. Prices didn't go down, and that's why we need a fundamental change here. That's what the New Deal seems to be in his mind. And so that one question I have for John is whether he's accurate in his recounting of the facts of what's going on in the economy. But the second, and I guess broader point I'm trying to make here is that FDR is talking about a New Deal. He's talking about making sure the economy is working for the populist interests. But I'm not so sure how carefully he's defined that at this point.
Yeah, that's a terrific question. He is, in fact, wrong about the economy of the 1920s not benefiting ordinary people. I mean, workers' wages went up considerably in the 1920s. So it's wrong. People made fabulous profits in the 1920s as well. And inequality did rise but it wasn't like the rich were getting richer at the expense of the poor. I mean, it was a classic case of the rising tide lifting all boats. Not the farmers. The farm economy was in rough shape in the 1920s, which is why farmers were liable to prefer Democrats in all the elections of the 1920s, including 1932. Farmers became a critical part of the New Deal coalition for this very reason. So yeah, he is simply wrong in saying that ordinary people did not benefit from the economy of the 20s. And it's interesting how the narrative that he builds, and you see this certainly in his inaugural address and a number of speeches, it's kind of a Puritan view of economics that says that we have this depression now because it is the hangover for the long drunk of the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That we were all having a good time with that top jam playing the stock market. And now we face the reckoning, which is why there's this strong theme in so many of FDR's speeches, his early presidential speeches and his campaign speeches, that what we need is virtue, right? We need a moral rehabilitation in this country. He emphasizes that over any particular policy initiative, certainly during the campaign. So yeah, what's FDR running for in 1932? Well, a moral revival.
That's a great point. That reminds me. Is it in his first?
Yeah.
Where he talks about the money changers in the temple and things like this.
Mm.
Right. So that's a great point, John. I hadn't thought about why that moral language is in so much of his rhetoric.
That's why he sounds so conservative, right?
Yeah, that's right. He does.
This is on the top of page 98 as well. I'd never understood this until John just explained this. It's towards the very end of that speech, accepting the nomination. He says, "Blame not governments alone for this. Blame ourselves in equal share." And he's talking at that whole paragraph. We shall have come through a period of loose thinking, descending morals, an era of selfishness among individual men and women and among nations, right? That last part, FDR's still thinking about this international question, which obviously is a significant question in the 20s, late 20s and early 30s. So there is this moral language. I never really understood where it was coming from until that comment from John.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that actually helps put a kind of political context on that language for me, because I'd always thought this was just sort of, this is his progressivism with all this talk of being ethical and being selfless and putting aside one's own self-interest for the good of the whole and things like that, which I think he still does believe, or at least some of his advisors believe that. But this really does put a kind of political context to it, which is very helpful. So, I'm thinking even in the Commonwealth Club address, is it the Commonwealth Club address where he talks about the insoles and the, or which speech was that where he talks about the,
right.
Insole is a great example of selfishness. It describes him as the example par excellence of the unethical businessman. And so, yeah, great stuff. John, can I ask as a quick follow-up, how did the farmers, do you know how the farmers accept, did they support the Agricultural Adjustment Act? They liked his solution to this, which was essentially to produce less.
To inflate
farm goods.
I guess we have to be clear on who was a farmer. by the way, this was the key to keeping the South on board with the New Deal. Southern planters loved the AAA. What did they? Because what did it mean? Well, they're going to take some of their lands out of cultivation. We're going to tell the sharecroppers who live on these lands and have worked them, sorry, we don't need you. See ya. And these black sharecroppers get kicked off the land, and the white planters benefit from it. Now, in the Midwest, you didn't have the sharecropping system going on, so the independent family farmers did quite well from the AAA as well.
Huh.
So that even after the Supreme Court declared the AAA to be unconstitutional, that ruling was pretty narrow. It just was about the tax on processors. So the AAA was the basic AAA was brought back. It was just funded out of general revenues, instead of out of this special tax on processors. And it's, of course, it's still the the basis for American foreign policy today.
Just a quick, I'm glad you brought up the farm question again, Chris, because this is all happening even in the 1920s with the Republicans in power, and I'm sort of vaguely familiar with the details, so I'm partially just throwing this question to John. Because Coolidge, does he not veto a bill that is a farm relief bill? And so you start to see the farmers, well, the farmers were never part of the Republican coalition during this period of time. That's a that's more of a new thing. So how is that all sort of in the background playing out here during the early media?
Well, there, I mean, there were a lot of the farm bloc were Republicans, but they were Republicans who often opposed the Coolidge administration. The panacea that was being thrown around by the farm bloc in the 1920s was called the McNary-Hagen Bill. And it was a colossally bad proposal. Here's how it was supposed to work. The government was going to buy up surpluses at whatever, at kind of an artificially high price, whatever you know, whatever was determined was going to give the farmers a decent life and cover all their expenses. It was going to be purchased from the farmers, and then it was going to be dumped on the world market at low prices. The effect this would have had on global farm prices would have been disastrous. In fact, FDR himself, which is why the New Deal doesn't go down that road. They focus on reducing, because under the McNary-Hagen Act, there was no incentive to reduce your output, right? You want to produce more because the government's going to buy everything that you everything you can't sell. So the New Deal farm policy, fortunately, went in a different direction.
So there were no farm subsidies, right, under the agricultural subsidies in the sense that the government's essentially purchasing surpluses. It was all a matter of price regulation by controlling output or production, right, with expected demand domestically. Is that is that the right understanding of the purpose of the act?
That's right. Yeah, you're just going to reduce the production by getting farmers to sign contracts agreeing to take X amount of land out of cultivation. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly how it worked for stuff like hogs. That was one of the basic commodities as well.
Now, this is going to call forth, of course, an increased need for some sort of regulatory apparatus to look into these things, right? So I'm wondering what's the larger effect of the New Deal on what we think of today as the growth of the administrative state? Again, I'd love to hear both your thoughts on this, but Joe, you've written about this recently, right? So do you trace the real rise of the administrative state, or as you call it in your book titled Bureaucracy, do we trace this to FDR primarily?
I think there's more of it in place before the New Deal than we normally think of.
Okay.
Federal Reserve, Federal Trade Commission, the Expanded Interstate Commerce Commission. So Woodrow Wilson is doing a lot of this, and then plus there's all the war stuff, which does get scaled back after the war, but it's kind of a nice precedent for bureaucracy that FDR can draw upon during the New Deal. But I think with that small sort of caveat aside, yes, I think the New Deal is kind of the first great, the second act of the first great expansion of administrative government in the 20th century. So you just look at the litany of very, very powerful agencies. Of course, you have NIR, you know, the National Recovery Administration, which doesn't survive the Supreme Court's decisions. But then you have, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission, FDIC, which doesn't seem to be that important of an agency today, but which was relatively significant back then. National Labor Relations Board eventually comes out of this, and Social Security Administration, right? So FDR really is responsible for the creation of a pretty significant part of the federal bureaucracy even today.
And did you think, I get asked this question all the time in my classes, so I'd love to hear what both of you think about this. Did Roosevelt think of these as permanent fixtures of the administrative landscape, or were these temporary measures to deal with temporary crises?
I think the former, the most famous passage of the Commonwealth Club address, right, the day of enlightened administration has come, that strikes me to have been his attitude, or at least, you know, he was convinced by many of his advisors that that was the case. We've mentioned Tugwell a few times, right? Planning must replace laissez-faire. So I think he thought that this was the kind of the permanent thing. And this goes back to the points we were making earlier about Hoover being kind of a believer in the dynamic economy. So coordination of activity is the best way to go. Whereas the Commonwealth Club address, in a way, has this conservative element to it, that the future, you know, the frontier is closed. All of the development and expansion that we've experienced in the past, we can't replicate now. Now we have the sober task of sort of like administering the economy rather than facilitating its expansion. And so that's where I think the permanence of these agencies comes about, is that we're now going to administer the economy instead of kind of facilitate its growth.
So it's not the enlightened age of administration has come for a while and it will go away. It's here. It's arrived, but it's here. That's interesting.
And this, and really, the rise of the administrative state in some ways made the New Deal less popular. For example, farmers were happy to get subsidies from the AAA, but when you get these bright, old, young, left-leaning lawyers who probably have never worked on a farm in their life telling farmers how to do their jobs, then that becomes that grates on people. So you look at who actually staffs a lot of these bureaucracies, and there are people who are well to the left of FDR. Mm-hmm. And sometimes FDR has to get people to slap these guys back into place because they're creating too much turmoil, and they're alienating important constituencies.
Yeah, that's great. So we end up kind of where I think in some ways we still are today among the general public, which is a lot of expectation for government to do things for us. But we still tend not to like it when we feel like the bureaucracy or administrative regulations are stepping on our liberty or something like that, right? So
yeah,
I wonder if that is really magnified maybe for the first time since you were just describing, John, during the New Deal. So we've actually come to the end of our time. That's really just flown by. So I'd love to hear your last thoughts on what can we take away? What should we take away from Hoover and FDR in light of this election? What's the takeaway from this? For those joining us, what's the most important thing that we remember about Hoover and FDR in light of this?
So I'll go first so that John can have the last word, because I've learned a lot actually just from listening to his thoughts here. I think for me the most important brief thing to kind of come away from is that Hoover is not really the same Hoover that he's portrayed as being in the history books and even in the textbooks. That Hoover wasn't just sitting on his hands, wasn't a stand patter. He really did have this really great legacy of progressive accomplishments, and I think in some ways we should give him a little bit more credit in how we teach the next generation about this period. I think that's probably the biggest thing. You know, we give FDR so much credit, and I think rightfully so. He won the election. He sort of governed the country through the crisis. But Hoover, I think, doesn't get as much credit as he deserves.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
I totally agree with that. Although in some ways I think that he probably did more harm by action than he did by inaction during his 4 years in office. Now, one thing you may know that there is I've edited a book in the series of document collections on the Great Depression and the New Deal, and the full length version of Hoover's letter to Simon Fest is in there. I really recommend that people read that, because he goes through the various phases of the Depression, and really, it's not a story of stock market crash, economy going down, 1929 to 1932, and then FDR coming in and it goes up.
Right.
It's a lot more complicated than that. There are fits and starts. There are points during Hoover's administration, including during the campaign, by the way, when things genuinely seem to be getting better. There are also periods in when FDR is in office where things look like they're stagnating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's fantastic. That helps bring a lot of perspective to it. So, Thanks very much to both of you for doing this, John. You mentioned the reader that's part of the Ashbrook series of readers on the Great Depression and the New Deal. Strongly recommend that. Which you can get a copy of. I think you can get copies of this, electronic copies, by going to the TAH.org website if you haven't done so already. And Joe, you mentioned you're working on the one on Congress, I believe, right?
Yeah, that's coming out this year.
Look forward to getting that as well. I should also mention, by the way, these two very thoughtful scholars have written some great books, other great books. Joe, your book on bureaucracy is a really important contribution to the scholarship on administration, and I recommend that very strongly. And John, you've also written on the global Great Depression and another fantastic read. So look up these books if you're so inclined. They're very informative and great reads. So thanks again to both of you. It's been very informative. Learned a great deal. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. This was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. Let's try to do it again.
Sure.
And thanks to everybody joining us, all of our participants, and for your questions. Just a reminder, you will get an email with the link for the certificate of participation. If you did not get that or do not get it, just shoot me an email. I can see from my inbox I've already received a few, and I'll try to take care of that for you. Our next Saturday webinar will be April 6th. This will be on Martin Luther King Jr. versus Malcolm X. It will be joined by Peter Myers of the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and Lucas Morrell of Washington and Lee University. Hope to see you then. Until then, take care. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to another TAH.org podcast. You can find archives of all our previous programs, as well as information about future programs, at TAH.org/webinars, or on iTunes by searching for TeachingAmericanHistory.org.